This is virtually the 2nd of August 2004 at the Freiburg New Church Virtual Assembly. And I'm George Dole, and my title this morning, first lecture in our series, is the title is The Big Picture. In paragraph 71 of Supplement to the Last Judgment and paragraph 255 of Divine Providence and perhaps elsewhere, we find the observation that Islam was permitted or provided in part because it was suited to what is translated traditionally as the genius of the Orientals, or more accurately or more contemporarily, the Near Eastern mind. This is peculiar indeed if we take our geography seriously. After all, where was Jesus born? Where did he live? Where did he teach and heal? Where did he die? Where did he rise from the dead? All of this happened in what we now refer to as the Middle East. Not the very heartland of Islam, to be sure, that's Saudi Arabia, where the locus of Mecca and Medina, but Palestine is right next door. Well, the book of Acts tells us, in a sense, how this religious awakening moved from its birthplace in Jerusalem, north and west, into Asia Minor, and from there toward Rome. And this may well have been inevitable because in gospel times, Judea was a Roman province, a kind of backwater on the world political, religious, and cultural scene. And as the nascent Christianity moved, it necessarily came into discourse with the dominant trends of thought, with Greek and Roman culture. It had to explain itself to what we might call the Western mind. So the theological language of the church fathers is radically different from the stories and parables of the Gospels. It's a change in diction that we can see beginning in the epistles of Paul. So it might even be fair to turn the tables and say that the language of the Gospels was not suited to the Western mind. The Western mind wanted reasoned argument, not stories. The apostles were fired by the impact of a single personality. And they must have been painfully aware that their own personalities didn't have a comparable impact. So they had to fall back on efforts to explain, efforts to describe, and they had to do this in forms that their listeners could understand and appreciate. And this is just one example of the relevance of geography to an understanding of the Bible. The clearer our knowledge of where things happened, the better chance we have of understanding why they happened the way they did. We can and should take this one step further and say that the clearer our understanding of what is happening in the literal sense, the firmer a foundation we have for understanding its spiritual import. And this morning, I want to start with generals, and a theological reason is said very nicely in Secrets of Heaven. Generals are first disposed so that the particulars may be successively insinuated into them. For if there is not order with the generals, there cannot be order with particulars. Or again, from summary, when generals precede, everything stands forth in the light. And the general with which I would like to start is one that I've come to find particularly striking and I've mentioned on a number of occasions in other contexts. It is that Palestine, the promised land, the holy land, the setting of the Bible, is the only place on the face of the earth where three continents meet. Europe to the north and west, Asia to the north and east, and Africa to the south and west. And as such, it is not the center of a territory, it is an intersection. And it is small wonder that its history has been so violent. And this was particularly true in biblical times because the Mediterranean Sea on the west, and there is a nice map here. There we go. The Mediterranean Sea on the west, the desert on the east, funneled everything through the bottleneck of Canaan. Couldn't go here, couldn't go there. Everything from here, here, and here came through Canaan. So Palestine was not Manhattan or Brooklyn or the Bronx, it was the Triborough Bridge. It wasn't Boston or Portland or the White Mountains, it was the Hampton Toll Plaza. Its own area and resources were relatively slight, its strategic location was unique. Well, the Hittite Empire in Asia Minor plays very little part in the biblical story. Hittites show up at some critical points in the Old Testament, but in larger political terms, the European presence came relatively late on the scene with the conquests first of Alexander and then of Rome. And if we follow the course of the biblical narrative, we find first and Abram, whose family came from Asia, down here, through here, battling kings from Mesopotamia, and spending time in Egypt. That is, kings from Asia and time in Africa. We're told of this period of settling and slavery in Egypt, again in Africa. It's not until later years of the divided kingdom that Asia comes on the stage again, and it does so first in the form of Assyria and then in the form of Babylon. And the later chapters of Isaiah celebrate a third Asian power when the Persian Empire Cyrus is hailed as the Lord's Messiah for returning the exiles to their homeland. Then Europe enters the scene in the intertestamental period when Alexander sweeps through the region. And following his death, the African-Asian axis again became prominent when the African part of his empire was controlled by Ptolemy and his successors, and the Asian part by Seleucus and his successors. These were two of Alexander's generals who divided his empire. And again, there's Palestine caught in the middle. And the most accessible source of information about the Holy Land during this period is found in the two books of Maccabees. And Swedenborg incidentally mentions in Revelation Unveiled that it isn't easy to learn from the Bible what Greece means because it's mentioned only five times, three in Daniel, once each in Mark and in John. When we turn to the Gospels, we find the Romans in control. And since they are in control of Mesopotamia and Egypt as well, Asian and African tensions are minimal. Still, though, we have the visit of the wise men from Asia. We have the flight of Joseph, Mary, and Jesus into Africa. The focus of power has shifted to Rome. Palestine is still at that unique junction. Now, let's look at this situation in a little more detail. First of all, you cannot have an empire unless you have a strong standing army. You cannot have a strong standing army unless relatively few people can raise enough food to supply not only the army, but also everyone else. So if all your able young men are needed on the farm at harvest time, they can't be full-time soldiers. And this meant that in the general region under discussion, only Egypt and Mesopotamia were perennial contenders. Egypt had the Nile, whose annual floods brought new fertile soil with extraordinary reliability. Mesopotamia had its two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, with large stretches of lowland beside them that could readily be irrigated. Egypt was hemmed in on the south by mountains and on the west by desert. Mesopotamia was hemmed in by mountains on the east and on the north, and by desert on the south. So their natural direction of expansion in each case was through Palestine. They were two potential empires aimed at each other with Palestine in between. And we need to bear in mind that travel was slow, basically no more than walking pace for any extended distance. And this meant that international journeys had to be carefully planned and fully financed. They had to proceed along recognized routes from town to town so that provisions could be replenished as necessary. And the standard route from Babylon to Jerusalem followed the Euphrates River north to where it curves west, came to Damascus about here, and then cut down into the Holy Land, crossed the Jordan, the Rift Valley, either just north or south of the Sea of Galilee, came to the coast and followed the coast pretty much down to Egypt. So it came right through the northern territory of Israel, what would later be Israel, and completely bypassed the southern part of the country, Judah. It intersected this main trunk route, so to speak, intersected the route coming down from Asia Minor at the city of Megiddo. So Megiddo was an absolutely key military and commercial prize. Control of that meant control of international commerce. This was Ezekiel's Valley of Decision, and the Hill of Megiddo in Hebrew, that is Har Megiddo, Megiddo came into Greek as Armageddon, the place of climactic battles. There was an alternate route down the east side of the Jordan Valley, and cutting across the fringe of the northern fringe of the desert to Beersheba as an oasis, but this was definitely second best, longer, more difficult. So the Davidic Empire was highly improbable. It was possible, politically speaking, because both Mesopotamia and Egypt were weak at the same time, and as I will mention in a later lecture in this virtual reality, during the period of Joshua's conquest, Egypt was nominally in control of the Promised Land, but that control was notably ineffective. The biblical narrative tells of Israel winning battles against individual cities and coalitions of four and five kings. But these weren't kings of nations or of territories, they were kings of individual cities. The government archives from Tell El Amarna show them to have been at odds with each other more often than not. It's very unlikely that Joshua could have succeeded if Palestine had been unified. And as it was, only those two coalitions formed, and the conquest was not so much the conquest of a country as the conquest of a substantial number of quite independent little city-states. Well, what can we make of all this spiritually? Back in my seminary days, when group dynamics was all the rage, it occurred to me that there should be a way to diagram social relationships that showed everyone as caught in the middle. We tend to think of some people as extremists, but in their own eyes, they are caught between some very rigid ideals and the immense resistance of a hell-bent world. And when our theology tells us that the first law of providence is that we should be able to act in freedom according to reason, it is also saying that providence keeps us in a kind of middle place, an equilibrium that is described in the close of heaven and hell. Providence keeps us caught in the middle. We could hardly ask for a better geographic image of this than little Palestine caught in the middle between vastly greater empires. Well, it isn't that Egypt represents heaven or Mesopotamia represents hell or vice versa. Egypt corresponds to memory knowledge, as we're told, or information about this world. Assyria to reason, Babylon to the love of dominion. And in this, I think, we have an image of the way the outside world comes at us, so to speak. It does offer us immense stores of information. It does offer us fascinating intellectual challenges. It does offer us paths to power. And each of these can be put to the service of self or the service of the Lord. We can learn about the world in order to live useful lives or in order to get what we want at the expense of others. We can figure things out in order to understand what the Lord wants of us or in order to evade responsibility. How many laws have been passed to close the loopholes that have been found in the other laws that were passed? You have to learn the laws very carefully in order to find all the loopholes. That's the story of W.C. Fields in the hospital when he was failing. He was found reading the Bible. He said, "Don't tell me you're getting serious about religion in your old age." He said, "I'm looking for loopholes." And there is a love of dominion for the sake of use. That's the direct opposite of the love of dominion for the sake of self. If we look at Scripture, we find the patriarchs going down to Egypt in times of famine and coming back richer than they had been when they left. And if we read Genesis attentively, it turns out the patriarchs never did get rich in the promised land. Abraham promised in Egypt, prospered in Egypt. Isaac in Philistia, Jacob in Aramea. They left poor, they came back rich. Then we find Judah captive in Babylon, as I already noted in passing. We find the Gentile emperor Cyrus hailed as the Lord's Messiah. We find the Israelites in slavery in Egypt. These could be good, these could be bad. To see then what this may be telling us about our own spiritual lives, I think we have to let go of the sharp boundary we tend to draw between what we call or think of as ourselves and what we call others or the world around us. When we talk about having other people in our minds and in our hearts, we may not be simply using a figure of speech because we have taken in some of the qualities we perceive in them. Our relationship with them has changed the way we think and feel and choose. We're different people because of them. Certainly this is true in the realm of ideas. How many ideas has any of us actually originated from the word go? How much has been prompted by what we have heard from others? And by the same token, we don't deal with others directly, but through our perceptions of them. So our perception of the out there is filtered by our own experience and our own unique sensitivities. And what we say about other people says at least as much about ourselves as it does about them, and sometimes more. Another way of saying this is to say that there's no such thing as absolute objectivity or absolute subjectivity, that all perception involves both the nature of what is perceived and the nature of the perceiver. The proportions will differ clearly from person to person, from time to time, in the same person. When we're feeling depressed, everything looks gloomy. But then there are other times when we seem to be capable of a considerable measure of detachment, able, for example, to stand outside our depression and look at it more as an observer than as a participant. Still, our depression isn't creating the gloomy world. We're not simply projecting our feelings on a blank screen. We're projecting them on a world that is there in its own right. And when we're at our own most detached, we are still ourselves. We're not totally blank slates, passive, on which the outside world is writing itself. Because all our past experience is already written there. We can't help but perceive and understand the present in the light of the past. So we may best conceive of ourselves as having an inmost center where the Lord's life flows in. This center, we're told, is protected by the Lord and is present even in people in the hells, because without it we'd cease to exist. As that inflowing life comes down through the lower levels of our being, it intersects the incoming signals from the outside world, whether that outside world is the highest heaven or the lowest hell or the physical world. On each level, then, there's a kind of overlap of signals. Signals from within, signals from without, a kind of interference pattern that can be very confusing and hard to read, and that makes sense only as we gain some skill in identifying its component waves. A nice trivial example comes to mind. Someone defined a highbrow as, and I quote, a person who can use the word whom without feeling self-conscious. And some people are far more sensitive to grammar than others. In Secrets of Heaven, Swedenborg mentions people who don't, quote, don't pay attention to the meaning of the words of a speaker, but only to the words. They get very little of the meaning, and still less of any universal meaning, and sometimes they pass judgment on everything someone says on the basis of a single word or even a single grammatical detail. And this, I would suggest, is one of the hazards of a focus on politically correct language. You may not hear what the person is trying to say because the person is saying it in the wrong language. But back to geography. What I'm suggesting is that the nations surrounding the promised land picture those areas of overlap between our outer and inner worlds. So Egypt represents not just what we know about the physical world, but the physical world itself as it is coming through to us. And Assyria represents not just our rationality, but the world as it comes through us too, through that rationality, the sense that it makes to us. And Babylon represents not only our desire to be in control, but the world as it affects us in terms of power, its power relationships as they impinge upon us. And then if we follow the biblical story with this in mind, we find a picture of ourselves perceiving the world differently at different times in our lives. When we're turned toward Egypt, we are primarily concerned with information. And the world is a rich and fascinating place. We can be immensely curious. When we're turned toward Assyria, the richness, it may be because the richness of the world has come to seem more like confusion. We're caught up in an effort to make sense of things, trying to understand what connections there are, why things are happening the way they are. And when we're turned toward Babylon, we're feeling that things are getting out of control. We're particularly sensitive to threats to our security, even to the point that we may see threats that aren't really there. But even this is not pure projection. We're not creating the threats out of nothing. We're manufacturing them out of whatever material is available, and there is material available as long as there are people or things in the world that we don't control. Objectivity tells me that you are a real person with your own goals and objectives. Objectivity may tell me also that you're stronger than I am, that you have more money or more influence than I do. And subjectivity can take this objective data and add the emotional cast of hostility, telling me that you intend to use that surplus of power to your own advantage and to my disadvantage. Well, the fact is, of course, that the outside world is bigger than we are. And there can be times when it overrides virtually all of our own preferences, where it seems to deprive us of all our treasured freedoms. The most realistic rejoinder to this, surely, is the experience of Viktor Frankl, because he went through that most extreme instance of this deprivation in the death camps of the Holocaust. And even in the context of that overwhelming subjugation, he found different people responded differently, with no control whatever over their circumstances. Individuals still had control of their attitudes toward those circumstances. And this is very much what is being said in paragraph 71 of Divine Providence in different words, and I quote, "It is common knowledge that we have a freedom to think and intend as we wish, but not a freedom to say whatever we think or to do whatever we intend. Overpowering circumstances don't so much destroy our freedom as drive it underground. But unless we are sensitive to that underground nature of ours, we may not recognize that there is an inner freedom that has survived. And we may find ourselves exiled from our promised land, from that inner homeland. We may find ourselves captive in Babylon, totally driven hither and there by the power structures of the world around us." The Mikhail Kazachkov, to whom my book Freedom and Evil is dedicated, spent years in a Siberian gulag and bewildered his guards by the freedom of his attitude. He was so spontaneously aware of his own individuality that the things he was compelled to do were not supremely important to him. And he understood his guards far better than they understood him, so there was no way whatever they could touch what he valued. They assumed that he would eventually be crushed by having every waking moment controlled by people who had no use for him whatever. Because they had no realistic sense of their own individuality, they couldn't even see his. You can't hit what you can't see. Well, geographically then, on a spiritual sense, Mikhail was living in his promised land at the intersection of forces that were far greater than he, And he wasn't escaping from the real world. Far from it, he was dealing with it day after day, meeting it in one of its most brutal, inescapably brutal forms. And Swedenborgian spirituality isn't escapist either, because we're called to live in that inner promised land, yes, and to place spiritual concerns above earthly ones in order to live constructively in this world until the time comes for us to leave it. So the big picture, the picture of the tiny land of Palestine, situated exactly where three continents collide, might help us to have a big picture of where we fit into a world that is so much bigger and so much stronger than we are. The point of intersection is a point of balance, and the first law of providence is that no matter how immense the forces, we should still be able to tip the scales. That's it.
Thank you.